Welcome back to The Deep Dive. Today, we're tackling a huge figure, Noam Chomsky. Now, lots of people know him for his political work, obviously, which is, still incredibly relevant.
Definitely. His political analysis as well, it's everywhere.
Right. But our focus today, our mission, is really zeroing in on his linguistics, the ideas that just completely shook up how we study human language. We're going deep into that revolution.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story because Chomsky's work wasn't just like a better grammar book for English. Mm-hmm. It was a fundamental break. We want to walk you through how his theories developed from, the early days of generative grammar, which was maybe a bit messy.
Uh-huh. Yeah, complex, man.
Well, yeah, complex, but brilliant.
Yeah.
All the way to the much leaner minimalist program. And the key thing, the narrative we're following, is this shift he forced, moving the study of languages, English, Swahili, whatever, away from being just these external things, these cultural objects.
And putting it where?
Squarely into biology, into the mind. Cognitive science, essentially.
So it wasn't just about sentence diagrams anymore. It was about the brain, about what makes us human. Studying language like you'd study vision or something, a natural object.
Exactly. That was the radical part. Before Chomsky, you had behaviorism dominating.
Mm.
Language was seen as just, learned habits, stimulus response, things you could observe externally.
Like learning multiplication tables or something.
Sort of, yeah. Chomsky said, no, that misses the whole point. We need a theory of the human linguistic capacity itself, an internal thing, a mental faculty that grows, kind of like an organ following a biological script.
Okay, and the core of this biological thing, the absolute unique feature of human language, is what he called the basic property.
Yes, that's the bedrock. The basic property. It sounds simple, but it's profound. It says, human language is a finite system. We have a finite number of words, a finite brain.
Right, can't store infinite things.
Exactly.
Yes.
But, and here's the magic. It has infinite generative capacity. It can create a limitless number of sentences never heard before. And crucially, these sentences aren't just strings of words. They have hierarchical structure.
Structure,
yeah.
Okay. And each one gets interpreted.
Right. Each structured expression gets shipped off to two interface systems. Think of them as output channels, kind of.
Yep. Yeah, what are they?
One is the sensorimotor system, the SM interface. That's the part that deals with actually producing the language, the sounds of speech, or the signs in sign language, the physical output.
Got it. Externalizing.
Externalizing it, exactly. The other is the conceptual intentional system, this CI interface. This is where meaning happens, thought, planning, understanding.
So the whole language machine, whatever it is, has to satisfy both sound and meaning.
Precisely. Those are the constraints it works under. It has to generate structures that both systems can interpret.
Which immediately makes you think of it as, a biological computation, not just a handy tool we invented. Okay, so for this deep dive, we're drawing on analyses that cover, the whole history, the syntax models, minimalism, the biology, even the philosophical debates. Right, let's get into it.
Okay, so where to start? Probably with the foundations. Generative grammar, aspects of the theory of syntax, 1965. That was the big one.
Right. And he kicked off by pointing out things about language that the older theories just couldn't handle, puzzles they couldn't solve.
Exactly. Three really striking properties.
Uh-huh.
They showed why the old data collecting behaviorist approach just wasn't enough.
Okay, what's the first one?
Infinitude. Simple, but think about it. There's no longest sentence ever in any language.
Right. You can always add something. Mary thinks that John knows that.
Sarah hopes that Peter believes. Yeah, you can go on forever. It seems trivial, but it means language isn't a finite list of sentences you memorize. It's a system for creating them. We understand sentences we've never encountered before, constantly.
Okay, infinitude. Makes sense. What's number two?
Structure. This is maybe less obvious, but absolutely crucial. Words aren't just like beads on a string, one after another. They clump together in meaningful groups. Hierarchies.
Constituents, phrases.
Exactly. Constituents. Take a phrase like unlockable. Is that unlockable, meaning not able to be locked or unable to be unlocked? The string of sounds is the same.
But the structure, how you group the parts, gives you two different meanings.
Precisely. Or his example, old men and women. Is it old men and women?
Yeah.
Old men and women. Linear order tells you nothing. The structure is everything.
Okay. Infinitude, structure. And the third one. This sounds like the trickiest.
It is, in many ways. Displacement. This is a weird one. Words or whole phrases. They often feel like they belong somewhere else in the sentence for the meaning to make sense, but we actually say them somewhere different.
Can you give an example?
Sure. Think about a simple question.
Yeah.
What did you see? The word what is clearly the object of see, right? You saw something.
Yeah, its meaning relates to the verb see.
Right. Its interpretive position, where it gets its role, is after see. Like in the statement, you saw what? But in the question, we pronounce it way out at the front. What did you see? It's been displaced.
Okay, I see. So the early model, generative grammar, how did it tackle structure first, the hierarchy thing?
It used phrase structure rules, PS rules. These were simple rewrite rules, like recipes for building sentences. The most basic one was maybe S right arrow, NP VP.
Sentence becomes noun phrase followed by verb phrase, subject and predicate.
Exactly. Captures that fundamental division. And you could draw trees based on these rules. So for the very old man left, the rules would show that the very old man all hangs together as one unit, an NP.
And that explains why rules apply to the whole chunk, not just the individual words. He left, the man left, the very old man who lives down the lane left. The rule applies to the NP unit.
Correct. That's constituency. It showed structure mattered. But the real breakthrough for handling infinitude was recursion.
Ah, recursion. Embedding things inside themselves. Like Russian dolls.
Exactly like Russian dolls. That's the engine of infinity. You add a PS rule like VP right arrow VSS. A verb phrase can contain a verb and a whole sentence.
So, the woman knows S, the man left.
Right. And then you can do it again. The child thinks S, the woman knows S, the man left. You can just keep embedding sentences within sentences using that one recursive rule.
So a finite set of rules, one of which loops back on itself, it gives you infinite possible structures.
That was the insight. Finite means infinite output. It was elegant. It showed how a biological system with limited resources could, in principle, achieve unbounded creativity.
Okay, so PS rules plus recursion handle structure and infinitude. What about displacement, the words moving around?
That required a different kind of rule, transformational movement rules. The idea was you had two levels. First, the PS rules generated an underlying structure, the deep structure, where everything was in its logical or interpretive position.
So you did see what would be the deep structure for the question.
Kinda, yeah. That's where what gets its meaning as the object. Then a transformational rule would move what to the front to create the surface structure. The sentence we actually say. What did you see?
And back then, in the 60s, it seemed like this movement could go quite far.
It did look like that initially. People called it unbounded movement. You could have sentences like, which problem did you say that Mary claimed that Bill thinks that John will solve? The which problem seems to leap across multiple clauses from its original spot after solves.
But that sounds computationally messy. If things can just jump anywhere, how does the system keep track? And surely not all possible movements are allowed.
Exactly right. That intuition led to one of the most important discoveries in the field, locality. Movement isn't unbounded at all. It's heavily restricted. There are barriers or islands, as John Ross famously called them in 67.
Islands, like structures you can't move things out of.
Precisely. They're configurations that block movement. For instance, the complex NP constraint. You can't pull a who word out of a clause that's modifying a noun.
Give me an example.
Okay. You can say, Bill believes the claim that John solved the problem. Fine. But try to question the problem. Which problem does Bill believe the claim that John solved? Sounds terrible, right?
Yeah, definitely ungrammatical.
That's because the phrase, the claim that John solved the problem, is a complex NP, and it acts like an island. You can't extract from it. Discovering these islands showed that movement, while real, operates under very strict locality conditions. The big question became why those specific constraints exist. What deeper principle explains them?
Okay, that makes sense. Constraints point to underlying principles. Now, before we jump ahead to minimalism, you mentioned the architecture changed, specifically the role of the lexicon, the dictionary. This was a big shift from aspects to that 1970 paper, Remarks on Nominalization.
Huge shift. And it follows the same logic.
Yeah.
Push complexity out of the syntax, keep the computational rules simple and general. The lexicon is where you store all the messy, unpredictable stuff about individual words.
Like what?
Like which verb takes an object, transitive, which doesn't intransitive, which needs two objects, which needs a prepositional phrase. All those quirky requirements. Before aspects, grammars had incredibly complex PS rules with subclasses for verbs like V transitive, V intransitive.
Right, cluttering up the syntax.
Totally. The move was to simplify the syntax rules, maybe just VP right arrow duller. NPS, allowing for an optional noun phrase object and an optional sentence object. And then you store the specific needs of each verb in its lexical entry. Hit needs an NP. Sleep needs nothing. Put needs an NP and a PP.
So the syntax is the general blueprint. The lexicon holds the specific instructions for each word. Much cleaner.
Much cleaner. And remarks on nominalization push this lexicalist approach even further. It looked at pairs like the verb destroy and the noun destruction, or recite and recital.
And argued they weren't related by a transformational rule. Like, you don't derive destruction from destroy syntactically.
Exactly. The argument was that the relationship had to be lexical. They're listed separately in the lexicon, maybe connected by a rule within the lexicon, but not by a syntactic transformation. Why? Because deriving the noun from the verb phrase messes things up too much.
How so?
Well, look at the enemy destroyed the city. Clear agent, clear patient. But in the enemy's destruction of the city, the grammatical relations change, the verbiness is gone, the meaning isn't always exactly parallel. Trying to derive one from the other with a transformation would violate fundamental principles that were emerging.
Principles like?
Like the projection principle. The idea that lexical properties, like needing an object, must be represented at every level of syntax. Transforming a verb into a noun inherently changes those properties. Or the inclusiveness condition, which later became key in minimalism.
What's that?
Basically, the syntax can't just invent new features or categories out of thin air. It can only combine and rearrange features that come from the lexicon. Deriving destruction, a noun, from destroy, a verb, seems to violate that you're adding nounness somehow. So the conclusion was, these relationships are stored, not computed by the main syntax. Keep the syntax pure and general.
Right. Offload the irregularities to the lexicon. Okay, so that sets the stage for the next big leap towards even more simplicity.
Exactly. Towards minimalism. Even with these refinements, the model that developed government and binding theory, or GBE, in the 80s was still pretty intricate. Lots of different modules, levels of representation, specific conditions.
A bit Rube Goldberg-esque.
Maybe a little. Yeah. Lots of moving parts. And that's where the minimalist program, MP, comes in, starting in the early 90s. It wasn't just about finding a better theory. It was driven by this deeper, almost philosophical goal. Chomsky called it the Galilean style.
The Galilean style, seeking perfection, like finding the simplest mathematical forms in nature.
Precisely. The MP asks, assuming the language faculty is a product of natural law, like other biological systems, could it be a perfect solution? Meaning, does it use only the absolute minimum conceptual machinery necessary to do its job? The job being?
Connecting sound and meaning.
Yeah.
The SM and CI interfaces.
Right. So the guiding idea became the strong minimalist thesis, SMT. This is the bold hypothesis that language is essentially a perfect system. It has only what's needed to satisfy the interface conditions and nothing extra. No redundancy, no weird artifacts of the theory itself.
Okay, that's a high bar. If you want absolute perfection, absolute minimum machinery, what's the core operation? What is the actual building?
The candidate for that is merge, a single, incredibly simple operation. Merge takes two syntactic objects, let's call them X and Y, and just combines them. It forms a new object, which is simply the set containing those two things, X, Y.
A set, not an ordered pair.
Crucially, a set, X, Y, is the same as Y. Order isn't inherent in the basic operation.
Okay, simple enough. But how does this one operation do everything? Didn't the old system need PS rules for building structure and movement rules for displacement?
Yes, and that's the beauty, the grand collapse, as it's sometimes called. Merge, in its simplicity, handles both. It unifies the entire generative engine.
How?
There are basically two ways merge can apply. External merge, EM. This is when you take two separate items, maybe from the lexicon or already built chunks, and merge them together to make a bigger chunk. Like merging the and king to get the king, and merging that with of and Georgia. That's how you build structure from the bottom up. It replaces the old PS rules.
Okay, structure building. What about movement?
That's internal merge, IM. This is where merge takes an object that's already inside the structure you're building and merges it again higher up in the structure.
So you're merging something with a structure that already contains it.
Exactly. And that single operation, internal merge, accounts for all displacement phenomena, like the Wii movement we talked about. What did you see? It replaces all the old separate transformational rules.
Wow. Okay. One operation, two functions based on where the pieces come from. That is elegant. But if you just reemerge something that's already there, what happens to the original position? Does it leave a gap?
This is where merge gives you something for free, a major consequence, the copy theory of movement, CTM. Since internal merge is just taking an existing element and merging it again, it doesn't move it in the sense of leaving a hole. It copies it.
So the structure for what did you see literally contains two copies of what, like what copy, ignoring details for simplicity.
That's the core idea, yes. Syntactically, both copies are there.
But wait, then why don't we say what did you see what?
Good question. The theory is that when the structure is sent to the SM interface for pronunciation, only one of the copies, usually the structurally highest one, is actually pronounced. The lower copies are silent.
Okay. Silent copies. Why is that better than the old way? Didn't GB theory have something like traces left behind?
It did. GB used traces, basically. Empty placeholders, which were stipulated to be left behind when something moved. They needed to make sure the meaning was interpreted correctly, linking back to the original position.
So what was wrong with traces?
They were theoretical artifacts. They weren't part of the original lexical items you started with. You had to add them into the structure during the derivation.
Ah, and that violates the minimalist desire for perfection, simplicity.
Exactly. It violates the inclusiveness condition. I see. Remember that. The principle that the computation can't add anything new. It can only work with the features and objects provided by the lexicon. Merge, by only combining existing things, even if it means copying internally, naturally adheres to IC. Traces violated it. So CTM is seen as conceptually superior. It emerges naturally from merge without adding extra baggage.
Okay, CTM is a bonus for merge. What else falls out? You mentioned merge creates sets.
Right, and sets XY are inherently unordered. This has a massive consequence, structure dependence. Since the core operation, merge, doesn't care about linear order, left to right, none of the grammatical rules that operate on these structures can refer to linear order either.
So a rule can't say move the third word or agree with the word to the left.
Never. Rules have to refer to structural relationships like move the MP in the subject position or agree with the head of the phrase. This explains a universal fact about human language. Syntax is always structure dependent, never purely linear. The job of actually ordering the words for pronunciation is pushed entirely off to the SM interface, the phonology part. Syntax itself is purely hierarchical.
That's neat. It separates the abstract computation from the messy business of speaking or signing. But if merge is so simple and elegant, why do we still have those locality constraints, the islands? Why can't internal merge just copy something from anywhere to anywhere? Where does locality come from in minimalism?
Right, the system still needs to be efficient. It can't keep the entire infinite structure active in its computational workspace all the time. Locality comes from the idea of phases and the phase impenetrability condition, PIC. This replaces the older, more complex barrier theories.
Phases, like stages of construction.
Kind of. Think of them as specific structural chunks that correspond roughly to propositions, CPs, full clauses, and certain types of verb phrases called via PV star P. When the computation completes a phase, it's like packaging it up.
Packaging it up.
The idea is multiple spell out. Once a phase is complete, its contents, its internal structure, are sent off to the SM and CI interfaces for interpretation. It's done, locked down.
And the PIC is what locks it.
Exactly. The PIC says that once a phase, let's say phase alpha headed by H, is completed, the internal domain of H, everything inside it except the head itself and its edge, becomes inaccessible to operations outside of alpha.
The edge, what's the edge?
Think of it as a little landing spot, a buffer zone, at the periphery of the phase. If something inside the phase needs to eventually move out of the phase, it first has to move to the edge position before the phase is completed and sealed off.
Okay, so it's like putting a file tab on the folder before you close it so you can still grab it later.
That's a great analogy, yeah. If an element doesn't move to the edge, once the phase is complete, it's stuck inside forever. This forces movement to be successive cyclic, moving step by step through the edges of phases, and it naturally explains why islands exist. Islands are essentially phase boundaries that weren't properly evacuated via the edge.
Wow. So the PIC enforces locality as a consequence of efficient chunk-by-chunk computation. It's not an arbitrary list of constraints anymore.
That's the goal. It derives locality from the need to manage computational resources.
Okay, so we have this elegant, minimal computational system, merge, operating in phases. Let's connect this back to the bigger picture biology and evolution.
Right. The whole minimalist approach reinforces the internalist stance in cognitive science. The idea that to do serious science, you have to focus on the internal structures of the mind, these mental organs or modules.
And language is one of those organs?
Yes, the language capacity, or LC. It's seen as an innate part of our biological endowment, developing along a genetically guided path, just needing environmental input to trigger and shape it within its predetermined limits.
And this innate blueprint is universal grammar, UG.
Correct. UG is the initial state of the language faculty. It's what all humans are born with. It's species-specific, unique to us, and believed to be remarkably uniform across the human population, basically fixed since our species emerged and migrated out of Africa.
The big argument for UG always comes back to the input problem, right? The poverty of stimulus.
POS. It's still the core argument, yes.
Right.
Children learn language incredibly fast, incredibly well, and reach basically the same complex grammar regardless of huge variations in the quality and quantity of the language they hear.
And often the input is messy, incomplete, full of errors.
Exactly. And crucially, it lacks the kind of explicit negative evidence needed to rule out incorrect grammatical hypotheses. Take structure dependence again.
The rule about moving the auxiliary verb in questions.
Yeah. How does a child learn that in "the man who is tall is happy"? You form the question by moving the second. The second ends the man who is tall happy, not the first one. Is the man who tall is happy.
They probably never hear sentences complex enough, often enough, or get corrected specifically on that point to figure it out just from the data.
Precisely. The input underdetermines the grammar they acquire. The POS argument says there must be rich, innate structure, UG, guiding them, telling them that rules operate on hierarchies, not linear strings, that knowledge isn't learned, it's built in.
Okay, so UG is the innate state. Now, this is where it gets really interesting, trying to figure out when this whole system, this faculty of language, FL, built around merge, actually appeared in humans.
Yeah, the evolutionary question. If minimalism is right, and the core is just merge, maybe it wasn't a long, gradual process. Maybe it was a relatively sudden event. A single mutation, perhaps, that wired merge into the brain.
A single mutation creating infinite thought? That sounds traumatic.
It does, but it fits the logic of trying to find the simplest explanation. So researchers try to pin down the timeline using evidence from paleoanthropology, archaeology, genomics.
What's the rough window?
Well, it has to be after our lineage split from other apes, obviously. And likely after the appearance of anatomically modern humans, AMH, around, say, 200,000 years ago, but probably before major signs of symbolic behavior become widespread.
Like the Blombos cave findings, the engraved ochre.
Exactly. Those date back to maybe 80,000, 90,000 years ago. So that suggests the capacity for complex thought, presumably language-based, was there by then.
Okay, so somewhere between 200,000 and 80,000 years ago, can we narrow it more?
Genomics helps. Studies looking at population divergence, particularly of the Khoisan peoples in southern Africa.
Who speak languages with unique click sounds.
Right. Those studies suggest the sand population lineage diverged from other human populations somewhere around 108,000 to 157,000 years ago. Since they have language like all other humans, the faculty must have been in place before that split.
Pushing the date back significantly.
It does. And then there's the really deep time question. The split between our ancestors and the Neanderthals' Denisovans was much earlier, maybe 500,000 to 700,000 years ago. Could FL have emerged before that split? It's debated, but the minimalist focus on a single simple mutation like merge makes a more recent origin, maybe around the time of AMH, seem plausible.
And if merge arose relatively recently and maybe suddenly, what does that imply about its primary function?
This is a crucial and controversial conclusion of the program. FL seems to be fundamentally a system for internal thought, an internal language of thought.
Not primarily for communication.
Communication appears to be a secondary use. The process of externalization, getting the thoughts out into sound or sign via the SM interface, is complex, messy, and likely evolved later, possibly under different selection pressures.
So merge gives us the power for infinite structured thought, and then we figured out how to talk about it.
That's the picture, yeah. And things like the unique click consonants in Khoisan languages could be seen as evidence for this. If the internal system, merge, was universal, but externalization was a later, perhaps harder problem to solve, you might expect different populations to develop slightly different peripheral solutions for outputting the structures. Clicks might be one such solution that arose and stabilized in that population group.
That really flips the common sense view of language on its head. Okay, this leads us to another controversial area. Meaning, if language is internal, biological, how does it connect to the world?
Right. This brings us to Chomsky's semantic internalism, and a pretty radical departure from how many philosophers, and frankly, most people, think about meaning. He essentially denies that words reliably pick out specific things or categories in the external objective world.
Wait, so water doesn't refer to H.O.? Dog doesn't refer to dogs?
Not in the way we usually think. He argues against externalist theories of meaning, like Putnam's idea that meaning just ain't in the head. Chomsky says, for ordinary language concepts, meaning is very much in the head. and it's shaped by our human perspective.
What do you mean, human perspective?
Our common sense concepts, water, house, river, even language itself, are inherently anthropocentric. They reflect human interests, goals, intended functions, how we interact with things. They aren't the objective categories of natural science.
Okay, I need an example here. The famous water tea one.
Yes, that illustrates it perfectly. Take a glass of tap water, we call it water. Now, dip a tea bag in it for a second. Chemically, it's almost identical, maybe a few trace molecules added.
But we instantly call it tea.
Exactly. Why? Because of a human action, dipping the bag, and intended use to drink as tea. The concept shifts based on our goals, not the underlying physics or chemistry.
And the reverse.
If you had, say, some leftover tea, and you poured it through an industrial purification system designed to produce potable water for a town, the output, even if it chemically resembled weak tea more than pure HO, would likely be called water by the engineers, because its intended function is to be part of the water supply.
So the label follows human purpose, not objective composition.
Right. And Chomsky loves pointing out things like Diet Coke and Bud Light actually have a higher percentage of HO molecules than seawater does. If our concept water simply meant HO plus or minus impurities, then diet soda should be a better example of water than the ocean.
Which is absurd. Okay, so our everyday concepts are kind of perspectival, geared for human interaction.
Exactly. They're tools for navigating our world, not for objective science. So if words don't refer directly to external things, what are meanings internally? Chomsky talks about I meanings, internal meanings.
Now, what do they do?
They function more like assembly instructions for the conceptual intentional system. They provide perspectives, pointers, ways to categorize and relate things within our thoughts. They help us build internal representations, query our encyclopedic knowledge, make inferences. But they don't establish a fixed, rigid link between a word and a specific external thing or set of things.
So meaning is more about activating internal conceptual resources than pointing outward.
That's a good way to put it. It allows for the flexibility and nuance we see in word meaning, the polysemy, the context dependence. We have multiple ways of thinking about book, physical object, information content, or London, geographical area, population, government.
I meanings let us access these different facets.
Okay, that's a very different view of semantics. Before we wrap up, there's one more connection you mentioned, linking this view of language to morality.
Yes, it's an interesting parallel he draws. Just as he argues for an innate universal grammar for language, he suggests there might be an innate generative basis for moral competence too, a kind of universal moral grammar, meaning we don't just learn moral rules by rote.
Right. The idea is that we possess an innate faculty that allows us to generate moral judgments about entirely new situations, situations we've never faced or been taught about explicitly. It exhibits the same infinite use of finite means, property, as language.
We apply underlying principles to new cases.
Exactly. We have finite principles, perhaps related to fairness, harm, intent, and so on, and we can apply them generatively to an unbounded range of complex ethical dilemmas. For Chomsky, this reflects a biological endowment for sociability, cooperation, and even freedom, the capacity to make reasoned judgments rather than just react instinctively or based on conditioning.
So the same computational principles might underlie both language and our moral sense. That's a powerful idea.
It is. It paints a picture of human nature rooted in these innate generative capacities.
Okay, let's try to bring this all together. When you look back at Chomsky's decades of work in linguistics, what's the absolute core contribution?
I think it has to be fundamentally shifting the object of study, anchoring language firmly in biology and the mind, treating it as a natural object, a mental organ, subject to scientific inquiry like any other biological system.
And that shift forced a particular kind of theorizing.
Yes, it drove the relentless pursuit of simplicity and explanatory depth, constantly asking, what's the simplest mechanism that could possibly account for these complex phenomena? This led from the complexities of early transformations to the radical minimalism of merge. It forced the field to confront deep puzzles, infinitude, structure dependence, displacement, locality, and propose computationally explicit solutions.
Solutions like recursion, merge, copies, phases.
Exactly. And in doing so, it challenged deeply ingrained beliefs that language is primarily for communication, that meaning is about reference, that learning is just habit formation. It opened up new ways to think about thought itself.
For listeners who want to dive deeper into these ideas, the source material is obviously vast, but where are some good starting points?
Well, for the linguistics itself, Aspects of the Theory of Syntax is the classic, though dense. For a broader overview connecting language, mind, and even his politics, James McGilvary's book Chomsky, Language, Mind, and Politics, is excellent.
And if people are interested in how these ideas connect to his more famous political analyses,
then Manufacturing Consent, co-authored with Edward Herman, is essential reading, showing how media structures can shape perception within the bounds of that assumed shared rationality. And for a deep dive into a specific geopolitical analysis, The Fateful Triangle on the Israel-Palestine Conflict is a major work, again informed by structural analysis.
Great suggestions. Okay, time for the final provocative thought.
All right, so if we take the minimalist picture seriously, if the core of human language, merge, arose potentially as a single, simple evolutionary step, and if his primary function internally is to generate thought, with externalization for communication being a more complex secondary adaptation, then why do we, in our everyday thinking and even in many scientific approaches outside of this specific framework, still instinctively treat language as if it is primarily communication, as if speech or writing is the language? Are we systematically overlooking our most unique cognitive gift, unbounded recursive thought, perhaps because its external manifestation is just so much more obvious, even though it might be derivative? It makes you wonder if we're still missing the true nature of our own minds.